9. That'll be our passage for this morning. So just by way of reminder, I think it might be good to kind of remind you how we get to our passage today. If you remember, after arriving in Haran, Jacob became quite fond of Laban's younger daughter, Rachel. He wasn't immediately aware that Laban had an older daughter, Leah, and so he had desired to marry Rachel. So he ultimately offers to work for Laban because he didn't have the dowry. In fact, there's another verse in Genesis where he basically says that he came only with his staff when he went to Laban. That's all he had. And so he agrees to work for Laban for 7 years as a dowry to receive Rachel as his wife. But you remember the story how Laban performs a little switcheroo at the last minute. So after 7 years, Jacob says, "Let me have my wife." They throw a big celebration, the wedding feast, and through acts of deception, Laban delivers Leah to him. He consummates the marriage with Leah, discovers the next morning that Laban had deceived him. So when he confronts Laban, Laban basically says, "Well, I couldn't have violated culture and the norms and everything else, and we don't give away the youngest before the oldest. And in essence, I had to do it. Don't blame me." But then he agrees. He said, "Look, here's the deal. Fulfill your obligation to her, and I'll go ahead and I'll give you both, two for the price of one. Not really, because I'm going to make you work for another 7 years." So Jacob agrees to work an additional 7 years. So he's married to both Rachel and Leah. And if we look at chapter 29, verse 28, or chapter 29, verse 28, it says, "Jacob did so and completed her week," meaning Leah, "and he gave him his daughter Rachel as his wife as well. Laban also gave his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her maid. So Jacob went in to Rachel also, and indeed he loved Rachel more than Leah. And he served with Laban for another 7 years." So we're going to go ahead and look at this. We're going to look at three different things today. The first is that God saw that Leah was unloved and opened up her womb. Then we saw next, or we'll see next, that Leah and Rachel's jealousy towards one another leads to this sibling rivalry, if you will. And then lastly, we see that God will ultimately remember Rachel and open her womb as well. So we're going to look at that, and then we're going to keep our takeaways till the end and see what this might have to do with this today, because it's a rather strange passage. In fact, I've noticed as I've been working through this, a couple of the introductions to my notes I put in, this is another one of those strange passages. And this is one of them where you look at it and you kind of read through it and you kind of go, "What am I going to do with this?" It's basically a battle between two sisters, and how is that going to apply to our lives? So we'll try to bring it all together and some things that we can learn. We're going to have to look at the principles behind these verses this morning. But let's go ahead and look at just the first five verses or so. God sees that Leah was unloved, and so he opens up her womb. Start in chapter 29, verse 30. "So Jacob went into Rachel also, and indeed he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served with Laban for another 7 years. Now the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, and he opened up her womb, but Rachel was barren. Leah conceived and bore a son and named him Reuben, for she said, 'Because the Lord has seen my affliction, surely now my husband will love me.' Then she conceived again and bore a son and said, 'Because the Lord had heard that I am unloved, he has therefore given me a son also.' So she named him Simeon. She conceived again and bore a son and said, 'Now this time my husband will become attached to me, because I have borne him three sons. Therefore he was named Levi.' And she conceived again and bore a son and said, 'This time I will praise the Lord.' Therefore she named him Judah. Then she stopped bearing." Now this word in verse 30 is translated unloved. I think unloved, verse 31 actually. It's essentially the same Hebrew word that's translated hate in other places. So it's not just unloved, it construes a little bit more than that. It's possible that just hyperbole is simply being used here, that, you know, because he loved Rachel so much in comparison, he hated Leah. It's possible that we're looking at some hyperbole here, but I think probably something else. Think about this for a moment. Jacob was not in love with Leah. He was in love with Rachel. He worked 7 long years for Rachel. That was the agreement. In fact, the text earlier tells us that those 7 years were like days to him. And so on his wedding night, he gets deceived by Laban, and he marries Leah. I find it difficult to believe, and this is speculation. Dustin and I try to do a decent job of telling you when we're speculating and when the text tells us something specifically. So this is speculation. But I find it very difficult to believe that Leah probably wasn't aware of what was going on. After all, she had to have known Jacob was living with Laban. He had to have seen the interaction, the fondness that he had had for Rachel. She likely knew the agreement. But yet, somehow, she, under her father's direction, goes into Jacob. There was likely some deception there on her part as well. Now, can I say that absolutely, since the text doesn't tell us that? But it's likely that she was at least aware of what was going on. Can you imagine for a moment what Jacob must have felt towards Leah? He had been deceived. He now has a wife he doesn't want. And we'll see in the interaction here that there wasn't any fondness. And that might be why the word unloved or Jacob hated Leah might be used here. There was likely some animosity. But I think it also suggests that he didn't treat her very well. That usually goes along with this concept of hating someone, not loving someone, because as we all know, oftentimes in the scripture, the word for love is an action word. To love someone doesn't just mean fondness towards them, it's the way you behave towards them, it's the way you act towards them. For God so loved the world, what? That he was just really affectionate toward us. That's not what the passage says. For God so loved the world that he gave. That's the concept of biblical love. When Paul talks about a husband loving his wife, it says what? He's supposed to nourish and cherish her because Christ does that with us. So love is an action word in much the same way hate is an action word too. And so likely what's being conveyed by this verse that he loved Leah or loved Rachel but hated Leah probably implies that there was some strong feelings of dislike, some maybe improper treatment towards her. And so as God is looking down, what this passage tells us is that when he looks down and he sees Leah's plight, you guys pronounce it Leah or Leah? Is it Leah? Some, I've heard it both ways. You may hear me alternate this morning just to keep both sides happy. But when God looks down and sees her plight, when he sees her distress, he responds to her. I want you to take a look at this. It says that, now the Lord saw, verse 31, that Leah was unloved, so he opened her womb. But Rachel remained barren. This exact phrase, Yahweh saw, or the Lord saw in your translations, is used 8 times in the Old Testament, as far as I can tell. And in every instance, it precedes a time where God acts on behalf of what he had seen. So when you see this, Yahweh saw. It's not just, well, he was aware of it or he could see it. It's that God was going to do something about it. Because God seeing something implies that God is going to act, and that's exactly what we see here. It precedes an act of God. Here, in contrast to Rachel, who was barren, God sees Leah's condition, and it says that he opened her womb and she gave birth to 4 sons. Now this is interesting because there's 2 things that stand out here with these 4 sons, with Leah's response or how she views this stuff. The first is that she directly attributes their birth to the hand of God. I want you to look at a few things here. The first thing is that she attributes their birth to the hand of God. After Reuben was born, verse 32, she says, because Yahweh has seen my affliction. So she looks at the birth of Reuben as God's response to seeing her affliction. Because God, because Yahweh has seen my affliction. After Simeon was born, she does the same. Notice in verse 33 it says, because Yahweh has heard that I am unloved, he has therefore given me this son also. Even after Judah was born, look at what she says in verse 35. This time I will praise Yahweh. Why? Because he has given her a son. So the first thing we see is that she attributes their birth directly to the hand of God. He had opened her womb, she has these four children, and she recognizes that this is all God. The second thing that stands out is that she hoped by God providing her children that Jacob would finally love her. That it would rectify her distress. That it would fix the very thing that was broken between her and Jacob. Verse 32, after Reuben was born, she says, surely now my husband will love me. After Levi was born, verse 34, she says, now this time my husband will be joined to me because I have borne him three sons. And so what we see here with Leah is God looks down and he sees the distress that she's under. And he answers her by providing her with four children, all boys. And she looks at that and she recognizes that this is the hand of God, and she assumes by looking at that, that God is going to rectify the situation she's in, answer her distress, and ultimately, what she desires most of all is the love of her husband, the affection that is due her as his wife. So that's how the passage begins. But now, because of that, all of a sudden, we next see this rivalry between the two sisters. And we will see them kind of go back and forth in this rivalry. It's a good old-fashioned sibling rivalry, if you want. The way I look at it here is Rachel wanted justice and vindication from God in the form of having children. She wanted something, ultimately, that Leah had. Leah now has children. And what stirs Rachel is that she's barren still. She wants what Leah has. Creates jealousy. On the flip side, Leah wanted love and affection from Jacob. You see, Leah wanted something that Rachel had. So they both wanted something that the other person had that they did not have. And so, like it so often does, it creates this rivalry, this fighting between them. I think I shared last week that Amy and I have been addicted to Cobra Kai of all silly shows. And boy, the amount of drama, the amount of rivalry in there because of this group wanting what this group has or this person wanting what this person has and all the stuff that goes back and forth. That's often the case. And so we see that with these two sisters now. So, the first thing we're going to see here with this is that Rachel seeks justice and vindication from God in the form of children, but she does it through her maidservant. Look at verses 1 through 8 of chapter 30. Now Rachel saw that she bore no children to Jacob. So she became jealous of her sister and said to Jacob, "Give me children or else I die." Then Jacob's anger burned against Rachel, and he said, "Am I in the place of God, who has withheld from you the fruit of your womb?" She said, "Here is my maid Bilhah. Go into her that she may bear on my knees, that through her I too may have children." So she gave him her maid Bilhah as a wife, and it's probably better understood as a concubine. And Jacob went into her. Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. Then Rachel said, "God has vindicated me and has indeed heard my voice and has given me a son." Therefore, she named him Dan. Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. So Rachel said, "With mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister, and I have indeed prevailed." And she named him Naphtali. So Rachel sought this justice and vindication from God by giving her maidservant. We all know the custom. We've talked about this before. If a wife was barren in the ancient Near East, it was a sort of a disgrace. And so she had a maidservant. She could give that maidservant to her husband as a concubine, who would then hopefully conceive, but those children would be considered hers. We saw that with Sarah and Hagar. And so that's exactly what we see here. First thing she does, though, is she confronts Jacob. Give me children! She blamed him for it. Unplaced jealousy and wrath against her husband. But he responds with anger of his own, saying, I'm not God. If I can paraphrase, talk to him about it. I can't do anything about that. So he now got this jealousy causing some conflict between Rachel and Jacob as well. But she decides to follow in the footsteps of Abraham's wife, Sarah. Does what a good wife back then would do, if I can say it that way. If you think about what's going on here, again, it's all about trying to be vindicated. She looks at her sister as having been able to produce offspring for her husband. She wants that desperately herself, and she sees that as an injustice. Her plight, her suffering is an injustice. And so she seeks to rectify that through her own worldly, earthly means, if you will. She says that in verse 6, God has vindicated me. Those are her words. He's heard my voice. He's given me a son. The second son she has, she uses this interesting phrase here, with mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister, and I have indeed prevailed. You notice the repetition of the phrases there. Different translations kind of handle this differently. There's some question as to whether or not she's really referring to wrestling with God, because that's literally what it says. I've wrestled with, in my wrestlings with God. However, there's some evidence in the scriptures where a phrase like that is really simply a way of referring to something as mighty or great. So another way to look at this is, in my great struggling. It's much like, you know, my battle with God. It's not that I'm battling with him, but it's as big as a battle with God might be. And so there's other examples in the scripture where that's used. So we're not really sure if she's saying that I've wrestled with God, or if she's really saying my mighty wrestling. I lend towards the second, partly because of what the rest of the verse there says. Basically, she says, with mighty wrestlings. That's why the New American Standard translates it that way. Yours may say, in my wrestlings with God. But again, the general idea here is that a wrestling with God means a mighty wrestling. So she says, with mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister. So she sees this as a great struggle, but now she's finally prevailed in her struggle because the Lord has opened her womb, or opened the womb of her maidservant and given her children. So we see how she is seeking vindication through this worldly means. Now, when it comes to Leah, because now Leah's also stirred up too. She's had something that her sister didn't have, but now in some respects her sister's on equal footing. And now that stirs jealousy in her as well. And if you think about it from her perspective, she wanted children so that she could earn the love and affection of her husband. Well, if she has that, and Rachel doesn't, who's he going to love, at least from her perspective? But now that Rachel has children, we're back to an even playing field in some respects. Jacob's going to love her. That's what's going on in her mind. So it begins to stir up some jealousy in Leah now as well. She had already borne him 4 sons, but it says she was no longer bearing children. Is she now useless to him because of that in her mind? So what does she do? She takes her maidservant Zilpah. She gives her. And ultimately, she conceives. She bores Gad. And she replies, how fortunate, meaning I'm fortunate now because, again, I'm having more children. They're not really mine, but they are mine, right? The second, he bears a second, Asher. And she declares, happy am I, for women will call me happy. So now she's got 6. So what's she doing? Well, she's trying to earn Jacob's affection through having more children. But there's something else she does. She's going to try to gain Jacob's affection through bargaining as well, and through additional sons. So I want you to look at verses 14 through 21. Actually, we're going to start down in verse Verse 9, when Leah saw that she had stopped bearing, she took her maid Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife. Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a son. And Leah said, how fortunate! So she named him Gad. Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. And she said, happy am I, for women will call me happy. So she named him Asher. We've already covered those verses. Now look at what happens in verse 14. Now in the days of the wheat harvest, Reuben went and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother, Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, please give me some of your mandrakes. But she said to her, is it a small matter for you to take my husband? Ouch. And would you take my son's mandrakes also? So Rachel said, therefore, he may lie with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes. When Jacob came in from the field in the evening, and Leah went out to meet him and said, you must come into me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes. So he lay with her for the night. God gave heed to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. And Leah said, God has given me my wages because I have given my maid to my husband. So she named him Issachar. Leah conceived again and bore a sixth son to Jacob. Then Leah said, God has endowed me with a good gift. Now my husband will dwell with me because I have borne him six sons. So she named him Zebulun. Afterwards, she bore a daughter and named her Dinah. And so what we see here, this is kind of an interesting thing. Mandrakes were essentially the root of a particular plant in the ancient Near East. They were believed to be an aphrodisiac. Some medical science says that they may have even helped with fertility. We don't know if maybe that's partly what's going on here. But most likely, because of the concept that it might have been an aphrodisiac and maybe that it helped with fertility. Her husband is out. He's gathering these mandrakes. In fact, they're actually mentioned in the Song of Solomon again. So there may be some truth to that. But when Leah's son Reuben finds some in the field and he brings them back to her, Rachel sees that. And so she demands some for herself. Why? Obviously, if it helps her become pregnant, remember, she's barren. So she thinks it's going to help her maybe conceive. We don't know for sure, but that's likely what's going on here. So Leah's response is rather blunt. Look at verse 15 again. Is it a small matter for you to take my husband? That stings, doesn't it? But from her perspective, it's probably true. Because she married Jacob. Remember? That first night. Rachel came afterwards. Was given the same week, but nonetheless, she first married Jacob. He's my husband. You've now taken him. So isn't that enough that you've done that? Now you want to steal my mandrakes? Meaning what? You want my husband too. You want these as an aphrodisiac. You want these to help you to conceive. So is it a small matter for you that you take my husband, and would you also take my mandrakes too? The two go hand in hand. So Rachel ends up cutting a deal with Leah then. She basically, Leah, gives Rachel mandrakes. But then Rachel says, you can have my husband in exchange for those mandrakes. And so what happens? Jacob comes back in. Leah runs up to him and says, guess what? I've hired you. I traded some mandrakes for you tonight. And that's the weird part. I don't really understand that. Because they obviously had been sleeping together before because she got pregnant. So how this all works out, I really can't answer it for you. Maybe some things had changed. Maybe it had been a while. Maybe after she stopped conceiving, Jacob stopped sleeping with her. We don't know. But she, in essence, hires Jacob back. They're together. And she ends up getting pregnant not once, but twice. And so she ends up having more children. Zebulun and Dinah, what the text tells us. But it's interesting because she still has this idea that by providing children to Jacob that it will somehow rectify her situation. She says, maybe he'll now dwell with me. Maybe he'll live with me instead of living with her. That's the great hope. Now, what about poor Rachel? So far, Rachel's still barren. She still has her plight, if you will. She's been able to produce two children through her maidservant. But ultimately, Leah's had six of her own, plus two by a concubine. Poor Rachel's all by herself. Well, God remembers her as well. Look at verses 22 through 24. Then God remembered Rachel. And God gave heed to her and opened her womb. So she conceived and bore a son, and she said, God has taken away my reproach. She named this son Joseph. And we all kind of know what that is. Joseph became the son ultimately that saved Jacob and his family as the drought came, and he became a fairly prominent individual within the family. So she named him Joseph, saying, may the Lord give me another son. And so now we see this similar phrase here again. God remembered. And again, that's a key phrase. I want to read just some other verses for you where we see that same phrase used elsewhere. It's a pretty awesome statement. It means God is about to do something on somebody's behalf. In Genesis 8:1, it says, but God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark, and God caused the wind to pass over the earth and the water subsided. God was going to now bring the ark onto dry land and save Noah and his family. Why? Because God remembered Noah. Genesis chapter 19, verse 29. Thus it came about when God destroyed the cities of the valley that God, what? Remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities which Lot lived. He remembered Abraham. He acted on behalf of Abraham. Exodus chapter 2, verse 24. So God heard the groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the sons of Israel and took notice of them. You see the combination there of God remembering, of God seeing, and God taking notice. Those go hand in hand. 1 Samuel 1, verse 19, and Elkanah had relations with Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. And it came about in due time that Hannah had conceived, and she gave birth to a son, and she named him Samuel, saying, because I have asked him of the Lord. You remember, she had prayed for a son. She was in a very similar situation. She couldn't provide a son to her husband. It was a reproach. And so she's calling out to God, and God remembered her and gave her a son. And we see the same thing here, verse 22, with Rachel. God remembered Rachel. Notice it says that your translations may say gave heed to her, or may say listened to her. God heard her prayers and answered her in her affliction. So she conceived, bore Jacob, a son, Joseph. I think there's another added benefit. Notice that she says that that God had taken away my reproach. Remember, that was a terrible thing in that society. A woman's worth was tied to whether she could bear children for her husband, and sometimes the number of children. It was an agricultural society. More boys, more children meant more workers. Plus, children were seen as just a glory to their parents. And so the more children you have, the more successful you are in the eyes of people. And so she looks at this and she says, finally, the Lord has taken away my reproach. He's answered me. He's heard me. But I think there's something else in this as well. You notice when she says, verse 24, she named him Joseph, saying, may the Lord give me another son. There's a new sense of hope here, isn't there? She hadn't been able to bear children. She watches her sister continually pop out children. But not her. So she has one child, and all of a sudden now it's, may the Lord give me another one. There's this new hope. And so as God hears her and answers her, it now instills within her hope that he might do it again. Maybe she will experience what her sister has experienced. So what do we do with all this? Like I said, this is all rather interesting because you get these, basically, it starts off in a very bad situation, a dude with two wives, which we know is not God's intent, at least generally speaking. It worked into God's will here, and we'll see why in a moment. And because of that, in fact, even the Old Testament law gives instructions when a man marries another woman, the law dictates that he cannot mistreat the first wife. He can't diminish her rights. God wrote that into the law. Now, this is pre-law, but why would God write that into the law? Because that was common. A man might marry more than one wife, more than one woman, use her to produce children, but he doesn't treat them all with the same love and affection. And we see that here. So God wrote that into the law so that that would not happen. If they chose to violate his standards and marry a second or a third or a fourth wife, they could not diminish the rights of any other of the wives they had. That's how important it was for God. And so here we see that happen. And so the story starts off with the two wives and exactly what we would expect to happen. At least one of them is going to feel unloved. And because of that, you're going to get rivalry between the wives. Gee, do you think that would happen anywhere else? Look in the Muslim world. It happens. Watch Sister Wives on TV. I've never seen an episode. I just see the advertisements. But you can see there's tension sometimes. They try to say it's all great, you know. No. Look at Mormon history. That's what happens. And so we look at them and kind of go, what in the world do we do with this? How do we apply this? Especially as they go back and forth in their rivalry and God's given this one babies, and then there's the maids that help out babies. What do we do with that? Well, I'm going to give you two takeaways that I think we can walk away with from a principle standpoint here. And these will be familiar to you, but they're good to be reminded of it. The first principle I believe we can draw out of this is that God sees and hears and answers our cries when we're afflicted. When we are burdened or we struggle. Think about this. We see this phrase or these phrases, God saw, heard, listened, remembered, multiple times in this passage. You don't have to turn here to each one. I'm just going to fire these off. But verse 32 of chapter 29, Yahweh had seen, or the Lord had seen. Verse 29, or chapter 29, verse 33, Yahweh has heard. Chapter 30, verse 6, it says, God has indeed listened to my voice. Chapter 30, verse 17, and God listened, or God heeded. Chapter 30, verse 22, then God remembered and God heeded or God listened. So that means 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different times in these verses that we've read today, it says something about God heeding, God listening, God remembering, God seeing. We always say this. You want to figure out what a passage is about? Look at what's repeated. That's the author's way of driving home his main point. You know, it's sort of like, I don't know if you guys learned it like I did, but as I was growing up in school, they always said, you know, when you write a paper and you got your introduction, your body, and your conclusion, tell them what you're going to tell them, then tell them what you told them, right? Why? Repeat, repeat, repeat. And it's exactly what we see here. And so I think for us, the takeaway with this is to remember that God sees and hears and answers us when we are struggling, when we're afflicted. That's the principle we see throughout the Scriptures. The Psalms are filled with it. Psalm chapter 34, chapter 15. You can turn there if you want to. Psalm chapter 34, verse 15. Says, the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and His ears are open, what? To their cry. The face of the Lord is against evildoers, to cut off the memory of them for the earth. The righteous cry, and the Lord hears and delivers them out of all of their troubles. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted. He saves those who are crushed in spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers them out of all of them. I was thinking about this woman at work I've shared with you before. Her name is, I won't tell you her name. She's in the accounting department at work, and quite some time ago, I remember I shared she had walked by my door. And she just said, hey Mike, how are you? And I said, great. And I said, how are you? And she's like, I'm not doing very well. And so I invited her in the office. We talked. She wept some. I was able to share the gospel with her. But she has continued to struggle with life, whether it's having to do with her son or with some surgery coming up or with issues in the accounting department. And so I see her, not all the time, but frequently enough I see her, and you can just sort of tell there's this heavy weight, and so I'll talk to her and I'll try to encourage her and I'll share about the Lord being able to carry some of those burdens for her. Well, this week she reached out to me because she had an issue with something at work. And as soon as she answered the phone, she said, "I don't know what it is, but when I hear your voice, I just feel like crying." So I teased her. I said, "I'm sure there are others that would say the same thing." And she's like, "I don't mean it that way." I said, I know. And she's like, "It's just there's a relief just talking to you." And this is before the conversation even started. Now, unfortunately, I was struggling because I had about 6 phone calls all stacked up. I didn't have time, work-wise, to just try to talk with her more on the phone. And so I tried to encourage her, but I just look at her and I reminded her of this. God sees. And He can help care for that. He can help. Now, I think she might be Catholic or goes to a Catholic church, but she doesn't have a relationship with Christ that I'm really aware of at this point. And so the hope is that she'll come to recognize that her burdens can be carried by Christ, because I am absolutely convinced that the Lord is hearing her. Saved or unsaved, I think the Lord is looking down on her and wants to answer. He sees her plight. Why? Because God's heart is toward those who are crushed, those who are weary. Jesus Himself said what? "Come to me, all who are weary, and I will give you rest." And again, when we take this all the way back to the gospel, it says, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. God didn't have to do what He did. We had offended Him. Romans chapter 1 tells us that we looked at the creation and we started worshiping it instead of the Creator, that we turned our backs on Him. In spite of everything that He's revealed, that's our life, right? And as a result, Proverbs tells us that the way of the wicked is difficult. Our lives are filled with frustration, with anxiety, with all kinds of afflictions. The greatest affliction being sin and the penalty for that. And God looked down on us and He answered. He saw our affliction. And the New Testament tells us that if He saw that and He was willing to send Christ for us, what will He not do? So when we face affliction like Rachel and Leah in this life, it says God hears us. God sees it. God remembers us. And what does that mean? That He just sits up there and goes, "I'm aware of it." No, because every time we see this in the Scriptures, it means that God acts on our behalf. He's there. He wants to answer. He wants to help. And He did that for them. He does it for us. Turn to 1 Peter chapter 5. Just a couple of reminders from the New Testament. 1 Peter chapter 5. Down in verse 6, "Therefore," it says, "humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you at" what? "The proper time." Why? Or when? "Casting all your anxiety on Him." Why? Because He cares for you. He says, "Be sober in spirit, be on alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking somebody to devour. Resist him. Firm in your faith, knowing that the same experience of suffering are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world. After you have suffered for a little while, the God of all grace, who called you to His eternal glory in Christ, will Himself perfect, confirm, strengthen, and establish you." If God is willing to do that, is He not willing to help out with the daily struggles and stress and afflictions that we have? I would have to argue yes. How about 1 John chapter 5? 1 John chapter 5, verse 14. This is the confidence which we have before him, that if we ask anything according to his will, what does it say? He hears us. And if we know that he hears us in whatever we ask, we know that we have the request which we have asked from him. Now again, that's not a blanket. You know, Lord, I need a new Mercedes. Not what it's saying. But it's saying that when we cry out to God, he hears us, he answers us, and he acts on our behalf. It's a pretty amazing God. What that ought to do is bolster our confidence and our faith and trust in him, much like it did with Rachel. That first child, and she says, may God give me another one. There's this newfound hope. And so I'm always intrigued as I remember what James says about when we face trials. And it says that we're supposed to be able to consider it all joy, knowing that the testing of our faith produces endurance. What he's saying there is, you know, when you look at what God has done in the past with trials in your life, that he uses them to build endurance. He makes you perfect and complete. And so much like Rachel, who had her faith bolstered as she saw God answer her prayers and answer her affliction, vindicate her, take away her reproach, she now is emboldened in her faith and trust. We should be as well. And so I think the first takeaway for us is that God hears and sees and answers us when we're afflicted. Second takeaway, and this is a little more challenging, God takes the affliction that we face, the suffering that we endure, the troubles in this life, and I believe he uses those to fulfill his purpose and plan. Think about that for a moment. When it comes to Rachel and Leah, what purpose would their suffering and affliction have served? Well, Ruth tells us, Ruth chapter 4, verse 11, all the people who were in the court, and the elders said, we are witnesses. May God make the woman who is coming, and she's talking about the marriage here. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like, look at this, Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel. Think about this for a moment. When Jacob leaves Laban, a couple of chapters ahead of us here, and he starts heading back to the land of promise, where God has promised his inhabitants will take over the land and ultimately will be like the sand of the sea and the stars of the sky. He leaves with 12 children, 11 boys, one girl. And those 11 boys and one girl, plus another one that Rachel will have, are the 12 tribes of Israel. And so God used this rather weird and sort of twisted story of battling wives and a rivalry with one another. He uses that to build Israel, to fulfill his promises to Jacob. Now, I'll be real honest. I struggle sometimes when God uses bad things for good, or when he uses sin to accomplish his purposes. It doesn't make him responsible for it, but because he's sovereign, he turns everything to meet his purposes. And so he used this situation, all the muck and the mire and the rivalry, he used all of that to build Israel, to fulfill his promises. Can I go as far as to say that you and I would not be here today had God not used this story with Rachel and Leah? Why? Because the Messiah ultimately comes through this. Isn't that crazy? But you see, God does that. He uses our afflictions and our struggles, our muck, and sometimes even our sin to accomplish his purpose. Kind of blows the mind. For many unsaved people, that really becomes a problem. Because they can't rectify that in their brain. That's because they don't understand who God is. They don't see him as sovereign. And so we look at this, and God used their affliction, their hardship, their battle, their struggle between each other. He actually used that to accomplish his will and his purpose. Romans chapter 8. we turn here quite often, and we always read the verses about, you know, how God will never be separated from God, and etc. But there's a few verses before that. Romans chapter 8, verses 26 through 28. Romans 8, 26. In the same way, the Spirit also helps in our weakness, for we do not know how we ought to pray as we should. But the Spirit Himself intercedes for us with groanings too deep for words. And He who searches the hearts knows what the mind of the Spirit is, because He intercedes for the saints, what? According to the will of God. And we know that God Himself causes all things to work together for good for those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. Did you catch that? This is about, essentially, us going before God in our afflictions and not even knowing how we're supposed to pray. But because we have the Holy Spirit, He intercedes and prays on our behalf to the Father. Because the Father knows the Holy Spirit's mind. He takes that and He then uses that, works it according to His purpose and plan, which includes our good, but ultimately His purpose. And so He can take the muck and the mire, the afflictions we face, and even when we don't know how to pray, God knows how to pray. The Spirit prays on our behalf, and God takes that and works it together for good according to His purpose. One last passage, 2 Corinthians chapter 4. This is especially true when it comes to God's purpose in the gospel. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Jump down to verse 7. But we have this treasure in earthly vessels, so that the surpassing greatness of the power will be of God and not of ourselves. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not despairing. We're persecuted, but we're not forsaken. We're struck down and not destroyed. Always carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus, so that the life of Christ may also be manifest in our body. For we who live are constantly being delivered over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus also may be manifest in our mortal flesh. So death works in us, but life in you. But having the same spirit of faith, according to what is written, I believe, therefore I spoke, we also believe, therefore we speak, knowing that He who has raised the Lord Jesus will also raise us with Jesus and will present us with you. For all things are for your sake, so that the grace which is spreading to more and more people may cause the giving of thanks to abound to the glory of God. Therefore we do not lose heart. But though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. While we look not at the things which are seen, but the things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. What's the point of that passage? Paul is talking about the daily affliction that he suffered under and that we suffer because of our relationship with Christ for the sake of the gospel. And he's saying here that God takes that suffering, those afflictions that are related to our walk with Christ in this world, and uses it to accomplish His purpose. And so, even when the suffering we face is related to the gospel, or our witness as Christians, God even takes that and uses that for His will and purpose. In fact, that's the way it's supposed to work. We're told that we would suffer for the sake of the gospel. And even that, even our persecution, even when we think the world is winning against us, God will ultimately work all that together for good. He hears us, even in that. And that's a hard one sometimes for me, because I think about, I have a news feed that tells me about persecution in the world. And I see these Christians all over the world that are suffering severely, and you wonder sometimes, why does God allow that to happen? And yet in some of those places, the gospel is spreading like wildfire. God is using their persecution, their affliction, to further His purpose. Much like He did. I just picked up a book called After Acts. It's about what does tradition say about the martyrs of the early saints, the apostles, and some of the early church. God used all of their suffering, all of their affliction, to to accomplish his purpose and his will, just like he did with Rachel and Leah. And so I think as we look at this passage this morning, we see these two things. God hears and sees and answers us in our affliction, but he will also use that affliction to accomplish his purpose and his will, which ultimately works out for our good, does it not?